Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Economics, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm Tim Jones, and my guest today is Nicolas Petit, author of Big Tech and the Digital Economy, The Oligopoly Scenario, published in October by Oxford University Press. People may love their products and services, but among politicians, activists, and commentators, the big technology companies are fast developing a reputation as the robber barons of the 21st century. Their critics claim that Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos, Sundar Pichai, Satya Nadella, and Tim Cook are simply reincarnations of Henry Ford, Andrew Carnegie, Andrew Mellon, Cornelius Vanderbilt, and John D. Rockefeller. In their minds, these are monopolist price setters with tight control over new entry to their markets. Not so simple, claims Professor Petit in his new book. The picture of big tech firms as monopolists is intuitively attractive, but analytically wrong, he says. A better picture is one of big tech firms as oligopolists, that is, firms that coexist as monopolists and oligopolists. Nicolas Petit is the newly appointed joint chair in competition law at the European University Institute and the Robert Schuman Center for Advanced Studies in Florence. Educated in law in Paris and Leuven, he was previously a professor at the University of Liège, a part-time judge with the Belgian Competition Authority, a research professor at the University of South Australia in Adelaide, and a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. Nicolas, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Tim.
Let's start by narrowing down the subjects of your book, and that's the group of the six that you call MAGNAF. So we're talking about Microsoft, Apple, Google, Netflix, Amazon, and Facebook. Between them with a market capitalization of more than $7 trillion. Now, central to your claim that these companies are not pure monopolies is the concept of indirect entry. Can you talk us through this concept and what it is that creates this mixture that you see of monopoly and oligopoly?
Sure. So the idea behind indirect entry is that compared with ordinary markets in which firms tend to enter and compete by imitation, replication, and substitution of products. In digital markets, firms tend to compete by differentiation, recombination, or by offering complements that move users, customers, and consumers away from the previous product and transfer value to entirely new markets. And so what you see typically that there are shifts in the types of products that you're that are entering into markets and that are competing into markets. And so, you know, you can take social networks as a good example. So Facebook attacked MySpace with a much more curated network of users addressing its product to college students. And then Instagram, which was then acquired by Facebook, attacked the social network space with architectural innovation by adding sophisticated photo capabilities. And then TikTok came in, but rather than reproducing what Facebook was doing, it basically complemented Instagram by adding music, dancing, and lip sync functionality. So rather than seeing this sort of duplication of existing products and, you know, working on price and costs to create competitive advantage, these firms try to exploit the modularity of digital hardware and software to really recreate new value propositions that, you know, business people would say resegments the markets.
Hmm. So where, given what you described, where does the even the monopoly concept come into play?
So it's easy to see monopoly if you take a photograph picture of, you know, the existing firm that has the dominant design. So you would say Facebook is probably a dominant company if you think about its position in social networks, because it has a very large user base and it sells a lot of advertisement on the other side. So if you were just to consider that the relevant markets on which you have to measure whether a firm is a monopoly or not is the standard social network, you'd say Facebook is probably a monopolist. But what I say in the book is it's not enough to just look at that. There's a lot of activity, anxiety, effort, and investment that occurs behind the picture of a monopoly market share. And this activity is completely inconsistent with the standard definition of a monopoly, which is a firm that is lazy, a firm that is inert, a firm that sits back on its laurels.
Yeah. And go ahead.
Yeah, so if you want me to add to that, and so I think that's a sort of dominant concept in the book, which is that what keeps these nominal monopolies active, running, restless, sleepless at night, is this pressure that is hard to observe, you know, with our eyes. But this pressure that comes from the threat of indirect entry, that, you know, somewhere someone's going to, you know, come up with a sort of new recombination of the products and makes a monopoly stumble. And so, you know, Google CEO Eric Schmidt one day, you know, wrote a line in which he said someone somewhere in a garage is gunning for us. But, you know, and some people said, you know, this is, you know, Google CEO, and we can't really trust what he says. But people as august and knowledgeable and influential as Joseph Schumpeter in 1942 wrote about that. They wrote about this idea of competition without competitors. And so the book is really trying to dig deeper into this very profound idea and see some potential to actually revisit the old Schumpeterian wisdom in today's world. You know, maybe Schumpeter was wrong for 60 years, but maybe the Magnaf today prove him right.
Yes, and you have that whole chapter of the book where you go through the filings by the various companies where they describe their concerns about competition, and it is very striking. And you also, you know, you point out the differentiation that certain companies see a lot more competition than others. Could you talk us through your thinking there?
Right, sure. So one of the motivations for the book that, you know, I kept hearing all the time around me when I started to think about that, you know, people talking of monopoly, and, you know, a standard consequence and implication if you start to talk about monopoly is to think about regulation, is to think about antitrust enforcement, and fines and remedies and so on. And I was really puzzled by that because you know, one of the things I do almost every day is I go to the tech press, you know, websites like Wired and TechCrunch. I listen to podcasts like Tech Meme Ride Home, and on my daily ingestion of tech news, I'm often taken aback by the sheer amount of business activity, intensive innovation, and entrepreneurialism. And so the picture of monopoly that I was, you know, starting to hear in my own epistemic community was totally inconsistent with all the sort of news cycle that I was exposing myself to on a daily basis. And so that was really the motivation behind the book. I was taken aback by this discrepancy between these two sorts of echo chambers, which did not seem to talk to each other. So then I started to think harder about whether there was really an echo chamber in my community, and that, you know, could talk about monopoly without facing any contestation. And I decided to go deeper into the idea that maybe in my field we're constrained by analytical tools and methods which prevent us to see a sheer amount of economic activity inconsistent with monopoly. And so the point was, maybe the method that we use blinds us to things which are incompatible with monopoly behavior. And so as soon as I started to frame the issue this way, I made myself, you know, more aware and open to other types of experts, intelligence that talks about these firms and that looks at other metrics of competitive behavior. So I went to the firm's reports to the Securities and Exchange Commission, which are typically not the types of documents that we use in my field, but also I also consulted a lot of reports, industry analysis and competitor reports, competitive identity studies produced by market intelligence firms, business data vendors, and financial investment institutions. And they do a lot of analysis of competition, and that stuff we never really use in my field. And when I started to tap into these resources, I witnessed a completely different picture of, you know, competition for some of them, monopoly for others, but a very much more nuanced and complex set of descriptions.
Yeah, one thing I found really intriguing was, and I forget which company it was, and there may have been more than one of them, but you mentioned companies that felt competition from units they actually owned. So particularly the messaging services. Is that something that you would have anticipated before you did the research?
No, absolutely not. So, you know, we tend to think of the firm as a black box, really, and firms are hierarchies, and there's no space for much competition. It's, you know, the firm is its own centralized set of resources, and everything is assumed to work on the same clock with sort of full coordination within the firm. So you'd not expect to see much space for competition inside the firm. And an interesting finding, as you rightly observed, is that various of these magnate firms tend to practice competition inside their own organization, believing that competition is indeed one process that allows to produce efficient results, efficient innovation, efficient experimentation. So messaging is one of them. So at Facebook, you have the Facebook Messenger, but you also have the WhatsApp product that they acquired. And to some extent, these two sets of applications compete against each other for attention, and they compete against each other for innovation. If you take Google, Google has Google Maps and Waze. And, you know, some people might say, well, but this is monopoly because they bought Waze, but they didn't discontinue Waze. They kept it alive, and they invest in the business. And so you have these two units within Google that compete. And this is a very interesting thing, because if you believe in competition as a good process to generate outcomes which are in the interest of consumers and in the interest of society in general, you should also credit competition within companies as a mechanism that will provide, you know, good outcomes to the company and, you know, probably to users and maybe to society.
Is that a concept that you think is already embedded within competition authorities and within competition economics, or is that something that really is new to this industrial sector?
So we know that firms from the non-digital sector, if any such thing exists, have practiced that type of strategy in the past. But I think what you see with digital firms is that they might be more inclined to do that than firms from other sectors. In your question, there's two questions already. There's, you know, is this a typical feature of the Magnav companies to practice that intra-firm competition? I think the answer is to some extent. It's fairly fascinating to see that, and I don't think this happens with the same intensity and frequency with other firms, but I would need to investigate that more. The second sub question in your question is whether in the policy world and in the world of people who think about competition and try to promote competition, whether that is taken into account, and my answer is no. So, you know, when you try to assess whether Google is a competitive firm, people would not really look into the firm to see whether there is competition inside it. We would take Google's market share as a proxy, entry barriers and other obstacles to competition, and proceed from that. In fact, the fact that the firm has various business units working in the same space might actually reinforce a finding of monopoly, right? Mm. So people would say, okay, Google owns all the navigation services, and that would be the end of it, without trying to understand whether these navigation services compete against each other or whether they are coordinated. So I think we need to really look into that.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Yeah. I mean, underlying this is much of this antagonism towards the tech giants really about issues of privacy or the publication of fake news? I mean, for example, on the left, Facebook is seen as the bogeyman, and on the right, although it's not part of Magnav, on the right, Twitter is seen as the bogeyman. And you say in the book, looking at these predicaments through monopoly lenses is like using Facebook to get your news. It seems to do the job, but it might well be fake. Do you think that's a mistake policymakers are also making on both sides of the Atlantic?
So the short answer is yes. The long answer is policymakers are specialized. And so you have antitrust policy, you have tax policy, you have consumer protection policy. This is the way public policy has been organized in Western societies in past decades. And the fact of the matter is that even though there is sort of siloed specialization of public policymakers in our societies, they don't operate in a vacuum. So the debates that take place outside of their own set of specialist remits have a strong impact. And so part of the anxiety and concern towards big tech monopolies is fueled and nurtured by a lot of external problems that that are tangential, but that are importantly related to these platforms, such as you said, privacy, fake news, hate speech, tax evasion, and so on and so forth. And so, to some extent, this works as a virtuous circle for, you know, the antitrust police and the regulation establishment to move forward, because, you know, there is indeed a lot of demand to do something. And so I think that reinforces the appetite, the demands, and the supply of new regulatory and antitrust policies. The problem being that if there is force to the movement, we should not confuse everything. And so one thing that we've observed is that there's an increasing amount of calls for breakups. And so, you know, this idea that you should break up Google, or you should break up Facebook in various units. So you should have Google, Fugle, Moogle, and Zoogle, for instance, competing for the supply of search services. Or you would like to break out Facebook from Instagram and, you know, have these two units separately sell advertisements to suppliers. Okay. Mm. So if you think this way, if you think there's a monopoly problem and you need to be fast and hard and you need to break up these companies, what you're going to do is you're going to basically inject rivalry in these markets. And you are actually you're not going to remove the problem that you had in the first place, the problem of privacy or the problem of targeted advertisements or surveillance capitalism. You're going to strengthen that. Because, you know, what's going to happen if you have, you know, more competition in the targeted advertisement market? The prices of advertisements, of ads, is going to fall, and suppliers will buy more. So, you know, the solution to more privacy, less targeted ads, might not be more competition, or might not be more rivalry. And, you know, people fail to understand that because they are obsessed with the bigness of these companies. But I think the obsession with bigness should not lead us to an obsession with breaking them up.
Do you think, I mean, it's the old cliche about to somebody with a hammer, every problem, you know, the hammer and the nail metaphor. You talked about the breakup of Google into all these different Zoogles and Doogles. Do you think that the people on the American side tend to look at these things through the lens of the mini-bells, and the Europeans tend to see these things through the lens of network industry? So the idea that you want to break up the railways into the infrastructure and the operator, the similar thing with the energy companies. Is there a different culture in that respect between the two sides?
Yes, yes, yes. So there are certainly a difference in culture. So America has probably a more polarized understanding of public policy, in the sense that on the one hand, they have this tradition of big antitrust cases with big remedies like breakups. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they also have a very established tradition of laissez-faire and free market policies. And these two forces neutralize each other very often. So they have this, what I want to say here is there is in the history of the United States a tradition of extremely severe intervention in the markets, counterbalanced by other periods of extremely severe periods of laissez-faire economics. And the big question for any observer of what's going to happen in the United States is, are we going to fall in one or the other in the future? Europe, by contrast, has a more centrist approach, in which there is a belief that government can improve market outcomes. And there is especially a belief that this requires a sort of tailored approach, which consists in trying to optimize the working of markets by some benevolent intervention, which often looks really like legal Lego building. So you know, tinkering with markets. So that's why in Europe, we don't speak so much about breakups, but we speak about inventing remedies like data portability, sharing the learning of algorithms. We speak about open banking. We speak about data ownership. So we are more into the, you know, the craftsmanship of trying to find the appropriate remedies that would allow us to optimize the working of markets. So we are less in the, I think, in the radical realm of, you know, should we go full laissez-faire or full big case and break up? And we are more into the, we can optimize markets. It's sort of engineers, you know, it's a sort of public policy engineering mindset that I think is more the norm in Europe.
Yeah. And I mean, based on that, on first analysis, what do you make of the new DOJ case against Google and the new European Commission case against Amazon? Do they reflect that different culture?
Yes. Yeah, so I believe that this European case against Amazon, let me start with that first. It has two motivations, which, you know, and I'm not talking here really as a lawyer, but more as a distant interested observer of what I can witness. I think it has two motivations. One is to eliminate the idea that the commission might have been biased against one particular big tech firm, and nurture, support the idea that the problems with big tech is horizontal. Meaning that there is a sort of common pattern of problems to Facebook, Google, Amazon, Microsoft, and, you know, maybe other companies in this space. So we had cases against Google. There's been a case in Germany about Facebook. Now we're seeing this case against Amazon. This sort of lends support to the idea that it's not a firm specific issue. There is really a horizontal problem. And that brings me to my, you know, second motivation for these cases, which is that it's very helpful, I think, for the commission to bring these cases now, because, you know, heads, it wins, tail, it wins, in the sense that the European Commission wants to adopt regulation. If these cases work, it will be proved that there is something indeed horizontally wrong with big tech, meaning the regulation is needed. If the Commission loses this marginal case, then this next case, then the Commission will be able to say, the European Commission will be able to say, look, you know, there is something wrong that we cannot fix with antitrust, and we need a bigger stick, and that is regulation. So these are the two drivers behind what we're seeing in Europe, and especially with this Amazon case. Now, going to the US, I don't know how to really read this game, but I've been having the feeling that, you know, in the context of the presidential election, there was really a need for the administration to show to some constituency that it was doing something against big tech, right? Mm-hmm. And there's that case, actually, the announcement of the case, which is really the case that is pushed by the Republican Attorney General in the United States. The announcement is you know, a few weeks before the election. I cannot help but think that it's not completely coincidental. But you know, maybe I'm just making this up, but yeah. I would be not entirely surprised if there was this, you know, strong political push behind this case.
Yeah. Before we move on to a core area of your book, I think we need a couple of explanations that you do outline to basically people who are non-specialists in competition economics and competition law, including me. Could you talk us through the concept of network effects and the concept of market tipping?
Sure. So let's start with network effects. So the network effects is something that happens when the pleasure, the utility, the benefits that I derive from using a product or a service increases with the number of other people who are using the service. Okay, so the standard example is the telephone system. If there's only one other person connected to the telephone network, it has very minimal value to me if I subscribe to it. But if there's 100 of people connected to it, then it starts to have a lot of utility to me because I can connect with more people. So this is really the idea of a network effect. And so network effect can be direct, we say, when, you know, in the case of the telephone system, the network effect is direct because the more people like me connect to the network, the more value I derive from it. Okay, but it can also be indirect. So, and here the idea that the value that I will extract from a service, the utility, the pleasure, the enjoyment, will depend on the number of the number of users from another category that will be affiliated to the service. And so, the typical example here is the video games, for instance. So I don't care how many other gamers are using really, you know, a video game. What matters to me is the number of producers of game on the other side of the platform, right? If I go to Spotify, for instance, I don't care how many people are using Spotify as a service. There's no direct network effect here, but there's a network effect in the sense that the more musicians post and distribute their music through Spotify, the more enjoyment I derive from the service. Okay, and we call that an indirect network effect. So what's interesting, and that leads me to the second concept that you wanted me to define, which is this idea of tipping. So what we observe, you know, from experience really, that in these markets where you have strong network effects, what happens is that at some point or the other, one firm wins all the markets. So, you know, the benefits that you're deriving as a user increase with the number of users on the same side or on the other side. And that creates strong rewards to one firm winning the markets. And so, you know, you can see that with word processing software, operating systems. You can see that with video cassettes in the past. I mean, if some people remember that, the VHS formats, you know, dominated all the rest because, you know, people started to share video cassettes and this was this sort of flow of big numbers and increasing returns led to one product, one application, one service dominating the market. So that's what you have when you have tipping. You have tipping when one product eventually conquers the market, and then in principle, if a market is tipped, it's pretty stable, and it can be a problem because it comes close to a monopoly position.
Right. Well, I raise this because I think probably many people who would have got this far through the podcast would assume that you are you're basically pushing back against this idea of monopoly in the sector. But in chapter 4, you take us through the Magnaf companies individually, and you admit that the sector contains the good, the bad, and the ugly in terms of oligopoly. And you say that the bad and the ugly deserve antitrust shock therapy to limit monopoly rents in tip markets and steer big tech firms towards competition in untipped markets. Can you give us some practical thinking of what potential remedies could be used and perhaps point us towards which companies are the bad and the ugly?
Okay. I was fearing that question.
You can always dodge it.
Yeah. You know, I'm a lawyer by education, yeah. So I certainly can do that. But don't nudge me too much. I'll try to give you some hints, though. Okay. So the point really in the book is not to say that all these firms are you know, great, and we should do nothing. So there's chapter six actually that talks about your privacy, hate speech, and you know, says that something needs to be done, but it's probably not a monopoly question. And also, you know, within the monopoly set of tools that we have, and the competition policy thinking and equipment that we have, there is indeed something to do for firms in digital industries that, and you know, this is, I think, the dominant theme in my book, these firms that are lazy, inertial, and that do not, you know, that sit really on their on top of tipped markets and don't do much to innovate, recombine, and enter indirectly into new markets. And so the, you know, firms that basically do not avail themselves of the modularity of the technology to create, invent, and produce new things. And so I say you can probably differentiate between two types of firms. And what I say about Magnav could probably apply to other firms outside of Magnav, you know, firms like Uber or Lyft or Airbnb. You know, you can think about them more broadly. And so the point in the book is to say, you know, if we look at a sufficient amount of performance data, we might get a sense of who's lazy, who's not lazy big tech. We might get a sense of which firm is sitting on top of a tipped position and which firm is sitting on top of a large position, but that's not tipped. So for instance, you know, one question that I cannot provide the answer to, but that keeps me really busy thinking these days, is when you think about the markets for app stores. So, you know, Apple has an app store and Google has an app store called the Play Store. And the conventional way to treat these markets in my field is to say Google has a monopoly, Google Android has a monopoly over the Play Store, as a monopoly position, even though it's a semi-open source system, so you can have other Play Stores, and Apple has a monopoly over the App Store, right? And so we think this way. So Google and Apple each have a monopoly in the application distribution market. Now, this is probably true if you take a pure market share view of these industries. There's no question that you can find monopoly position there. And I say, well, you know, we need to look deeper, and we need to ask ourselves whether each firm is sitting on top of a tipped app store. So, and the answer might be different for Google and Apple. So people would say, you know, people might come back to you with a very quick answer and say, sure, you know, these two firms have tipped the markets for their app stores because they are the you know, most dominant providers of app stores. And so, but we're back again with this sort of market share view of the world. And I say in the book, I say, no, this is not what the kind of investigation that we should lead to understand whether our market has tipped. I say what we should try to look at is whether this, whether each firm keeps investing, keeps displaying efforts, keeps displaying anxiety by channeling resources to the App Store, which would denote exactly the contrary of monopoly, exactly the contrary of a tipped market. In a tipped market, the firm can basically sit. And so, you know, data that's antitrust agencies, investigators could try to use are, you know, things like R&D expenditure in the App Store, employment expenditure, and also type of employment expenditure in the App Store, marketing expenditure, and so on and so forth. And so once we get a good sense of how much investment goes into these products, we can get a sense of which is the tipped App Store and which is not the tipped App Store. And that should drive policy analysis and remedies.
Right. All in. I mean, this book is pretty heterodox in its thinking. What's the reception been like in the competition law, competition economics, and actually in the policymaking community so far?
My hunch is it's been very well received. But you know, of course, I'm optimistic, and it's my book, so I might have some bias here. But I think the way the book is perceived is that it shows a third way between the pure knee-jerk monopoly regulation approach and the pure, extremely ideological, laissez-faire approach of others. And in a way, this third approach is very post-Schumpeterian in terms of how it thinks about innovation, dynamism, change. I put a lot of effort in the book trying to explain that, you know, a sort of dominant feature that we see in these firms is their flexibility, their adaptability, and we should, I think policymaking should reward that and should discourage or penalize firms in digital markets which actually fail to pivot, which fail to turn around, which fail to be, you know, mobile, and which fail to actually exploit the full potential of the data economy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I have a final question. And since this is a podcast about books, I'd like a recommendation from you. Is there a book or even more than one book that you've read recently in economics and or competition that you would recommend to listeners?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Apart from your own.
I don't read my books. And every time I read them, I think I need to write another one to forget about the previous one. So certainly not that. As far as an economic book is concerned, I think I would go to Schumpeter, I would go to Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy. And there's the chapter that Schumpeter really devotes to capitalism is absolutely amazing. I think people should go to it and read it because it's just mind-blowing. That's where he talks about the creative destruction and monopolistic practices. I think it's part two, Can Capitalism Survive? And this in itself is a book. You don't need to read the entire book. This part two is just absolutely amazing. I'm currently reading something that I find quite good because it provides a completely different perspective on the way these firms operate. It's the Reed Hastings book, No Rules Rule. So is this, Reed Hastings is the CEO of Netflix. And they have, so he wrote this book with a business and management science scholar, Erin Meyer. Mm-hmm. And he talks about how they basically manage the company, employees. So all the human resources policy and all the human resources strategy that they have. And it's quite fascinating because, again, this is clearly something that we never discuss in competition. But when you read the book, you have to be, you sort of come out fascinated by the amount of competition for talent that exists between these big tech firms. And so the motivation behind the book is there are so much competition to retain good skills in the business. We need to, and so the book is about all the policy they have implemented to retain these people, to hire good people, denoting a lot of competition for managers, for instance, and that is something that's completely out of what we're seeing. Now, if you want to ask me about a book I recently read outside of economics.
Yeah, why not?
And that I really enjoyed. So I reread something that I had read a long time ago. This is the Foundation, set of books from Isaac Asimov, and I'll tell you why I like that and the relationship with my work. So the Foundation set of volumes of Isaac Asimov is about this foundation that fights across hyperspace to dominate the universe in a way, right? And it's about, you know, there's this sort of civilization is decaying, and it's plagued by internecine wars, and one person realizes that the world is gonna, you know, is gonna come to an end because people keep fighting, and he creates this foundation, which is a sort of it's a sort of Wikipedia on a planet, which is the repository of science. And if the world collapses, there will be this foundation, which will restart everything quite quickly. Okay, so this is the sort of dominant theme, and it starts like that. Mm-hmm. And this person, which was a bit like a prophet, he basically, so this in this Wikipedia, it puts all the sort of hard science. So, you know, the manufacturers, the builders, the mechanicians, the physicians, so all the hard science, the material science got there, okay? Mm-hmm. And so what's interesting in the book is that, and this is a bit what we have in today in modern economics. So the field is dominated by material scientists, people who do physics. They believe they are like, you know, they believe that there's big laws that govern the economy, much as there are big laws that govern the universe, gravity, and so on. And you happen to realize in the book that the prophets understood that the world was more complex, and that the world was also pretty much explainable and more complete if you appealed to soft science. And so he created a hidden second foundation composed of people working with psychology, mentalists, he called them, mm-hmm. right? And so the entire set of volumes is a competition between these two foundations to keep the world in equilibrium. And it's a nice metaphor to what we have today in the economic policy world, where hard science dominates as the soft understanding of the economy. There's sort of domination in academia, but also in public policy for all the stuff you can measure. You need data, you need to measure everything. Mm-hmm. And all the softer aspect that Schumpeter was talking about, for instance, they are completely marginalized. And I think you cannot build a theory of the world if you don't have all the voices that try to diagnose empirical phenomena on deck. You need all them on deck. And I think today in the world that we face in policymaking and in academia, all too often we are more with the first foundation than with the second, and we need both of them.
Well, very wide-ranging recommendations. Thank you very much. Today, Nicolas Petit and I have been discussing his book, Big Tech and the Digital Economy, The Oligopoly Scenario, published by Oxford University Press. Nicola, thanks again for joining the podcast.
Thank you very much, Tim. That was a pleasure.